His head was so closely cropped, and his hair was so light, that for one unpleasant moment, Selden was reminded of Mycogen. The newcomer wore what was unmistakably a uniform. It was red and white, and about his waist was a wide belt decorated with silver studs. His voice, when he spoke, was a rolling bass, and its accent was not like any that Selden had heard before. Most unfamiliar accents sounded uncouth in Selden's experience, but this one seemed almost musical, perhaps because of the richness of the low tones. "I am Sergeant Emmer Thallus," he rumbled in a slow succession of syllables. "I have come seeking Dr. Harry Selden." Selden said, "I am he." In an aside to Doors, he muttered, "If Hummon couldn't come himself, he certainly sent a magnificent side of beef to represent him." The sergeant favored Selden with a stolid and slightly prolonged look. Then he said, "Yes, you have been described to me. Please come with me, Dr. Selden." Selden said, "Lead the way." The sergeant stepped backward. Selden and Doris Van Evely stepped forward. The sergeant stopped and raised a large hand, palm toward Doris. "I have been instructed to take Dr. Harry Selden with me. I have not been instructed to take anyone else." For a moment, Selden looked at him uncomprehendingly. Then his look of surprise gave way to anger. "It's quite impossible that you have been told that, Sergeant. Dr. Doris Van Evely is my associate and my companion. She must come with me."
"That is not in accordance with my instructions, Doctor."
"I don't care about your instructions in any way, Sergeant Thallus. I do not budge without her." "What's more," said Doris with clear irritation, "my instructions are to protect Dr. Selden at all times. I cannot do that unless I am with him. Therefore, where he goes, I go." The sergeant looked puzzled.
"My instructions are strict that I see to it that no harm comes to you, Dr. Selden. If you will not come voluntarily, I must carry you to my vehicle. I will try to do so gently."
He extended his two arms as though to seize Selden by the waist and carry him off bodily. Selden skittered backward and out of reach. As he did so, the side of his right palm came down on the sergeant's right upper arm where the muscles were thinnest, so that he struck the bone. The sergeant drew a sudden deep breath and seemed to shake himself a bit, but turned, face expressionless, and advanced again. Devan, watching, remained where he was, motionless, but Raich moved behind the sergeant. Selden repeated his palm stroke a second time, then a third. But now, Sergeant Thallus, anticipating the blow, lowered his shoulder to catch it on hard muscle. Doris had drawn her knives. "Sergeant," she said forcefully, "turn in this direction. I want you to understand I may be forced to hurt you severely if you persist in attempting to carry Dr. Selden off against his will." The sergeant paused, seemed to take in the slowly waving knives solemnly, then said,
"It is not in my instructions to refrain from harming anyone but Dr. Selden."
His right hand moved with surprising speed toward the neuronic whip in the holster at his hip. Doris moved as quickly forward, knives flashing. Neither completed the movement. Dashing forward, Raich had pushed at the sergeant's back with his left hand and withdrew the sergeant's weapon from its holster with his right. He moved away quickly, holding the neuronic whip in both hands now, and shouting,
"Hands up, sergeant, or you're gonna get it."
The sergeant whirled, and a nervous look crossed his reddening face. It was the only moment that its stolidity had weakened.
"Put that down, sonny," he growled. "You don't know how it works."
Raich howled,
"I know about the safety. It's off. and this thing can fire. And it will, if you try to rush me.
The sergeant froze. He clearly knew how dangerous it was to have an excited 12-year-old handling a powerful weapon. Nor did Selden feel much better. He said, "Careful, Rach, don't shoot. Keep your finger off the contact."
"I ain't gonna let him rush me."
"He won't. Sergeant, please don't move. Let's get something straight. You were told to take me away from here, is that right?"
"That's right," said the sergeant, eyes somewhat protruding and firmly fixed on Rach, whose eyes were as firmly fixed on the sergeant.
"But you were not told to take anyone else, is that right?"
"No, I was not, doctor," said the sergeant firmly.
Not even the threat of a neuronic whip was going to make him weasel. One could see that. "Very well. But listen to me, sergeant. Were you told not to take anyone else?"
"I just said..."
"No, no. Listen, sergeant. There's a difference. Were your instructions simply, take Dr. Selden? Was that the entire order with no mention of anyone else? Or were the orders more specific? Were your orders as follows, take Dr. Selden and don't take anyone else?" The sergeant turned that over in his head. Then he said,
"I was told to take you, Dr. Selden."
Then there was no mention of anyone else, one way or the other, was there? Pause.
"No."
"You were not told to take Dr. Venabile, but you were not told not to take Dr. Venabile either. Is that right?"
Pause. "Yes."
"So you can either take her or not take her, whichever you please." Long pause.
"I suppose so."
"Now then, there's Rach, the young fellow who's got a neuronic whip pointing at you. Your neuronic whip, remember? And he is anxious to use it."
"Yay!"
shouted Rach. "Not yet, Rach," said Selden. "And here is Dr. Venabile with two knives that she can use very expertly. And there's myself, who can, if I get the chance, break your Adam's apple with one hand so that you'll never speak above a whisper again. Now then, do you want to take Dr. Venabile, or don't you want to? Your orders allow you to do either." And finally, the sergeant said in a beaten voice,
"I will take the woman."
"And the boy, Rach."
"And the boy."
"Good. Have I your word of honor as a soldier, that you will do as you have just said, honestly?"
"You have my word of honor as a soldier," said the sergeant.
"Good. Rach, give back the whip. Now, don't make me wait." Rach, his face twisted into an unhappy grimace, looked at Doris, who hesitated and then slowly nodded her head. Her face was as unhappy as Rach's. Rach held out the neuronic whip to the sergeant and said,
"They're making me, you big..."
His last words were unintelligible. Selden said, "Put away your knives, Doris." Doris shook her head, but put them away. "Now, sergeant," said Selden. The sergeant looked at the neuronic whip, then at Selden. He said,
"You are an honorable man, Dr. Selden, and my word of honor holds."
With a military snap, he placed his neuronic whip in his holster. Selden turned to Devan and said, "Devan, please forget what you have seen here. We three are going voluntarily with Sergeant Thallus. You tell Hugo Amaril when you see him that I will not forget him, and that once this is over and I am free to act, I will see that he gets into a university. And if there's anything reasonable I can ever do for your cause, Devan, I will. Now, Sergeant, let's go." 83. Have you ever been in an air jet before, Rach? Asked Harry Seldon. Rach shook his head speechlessly. He was looking down at Upperside rushing beneath them with a mixture of fright and awe. It struck Seldon again how much Trantor was a world of expressways and tunnels. Even long trips were made underground by the general population. Air travel, however common it might be on the outworlds, was a luxury on Trantor, and an air jet like this. How had Hummin managed it, Seldon wondered. He looked out the window at the rise and fall of the domes, at the general green in this area of the planet, the occasional patches of what were little less than jungles, the arms of the sea they occasionally passed over, with its leaden waters taking on a sudden, all-too-brief sparkle when the sun peeped out momentarily from the heavy cloud layer. An hour or so into the flight, Doris, who was viewing a new historical novel, without much in the way of apparent enjoyment, clicked it off and said, "I wish I knew where we were going." "If you can't tell," said Seldon, "then I certainly can't. You've been on Trantor longer than I have."
"Yes, but only on the inside," said Doris. "Out here, with only Upperside below me, I'm as lost as an unborn infant would be."
"Oh, well, presumably Hummin knows what he's doing."
"I'm sure he does," replied Doris rather tartly. "But that may have nothing to do with the present situation. Why do you continue to assume any of this represents his initiative?"
Seldon's eyebrows lifted.
"Now that you ask, I don't know. I just assumed it.
Why shouldn't this be his?"
"Because whoever arranged it didn't specify that I be taken along with you. I simply don't see Hummin forgetting my existence. And because he didn't come himself, as he did at Streeling and at Mycogen."
"You can't always expect him to, Doris. He might well be occupied. The astonishing thing is not that he didn't come on this occasion, but that he did come on the previous ones."
"Assuming he didn't come himself, would he send a conspicuous and lavish flying palace like this?"
She gestured around her at the large, luxurious jet. "It might simply have been available, and he might have reasoned that no one would expect something as noticeable as this to be carrying fugitives who were desperately trying to avoid detection. The well-known double-double cross."
"Too well-known, in my opinion. And would he send an idiot like Sergeant Thallus in his place?"
"The sergeant is no idiot. He's simply been trained to complete obedience. With proper instructions, he could be utterly reliable."
"There you are, Harry. We come back to that. Why didn't he get proper instructions? It's inconceivable to me that Cheddar Hummin would tell him to carry you out of Dahl and not say a word about me. Inconceivable."
And to that Seldon had no answer, and his spirit sank. Another hour passed, and Doris said,
"It looks as if it's getting colder outside. The green of Upperside is turning brown, and I believe the heaters have turned on."
"What does that signify?"
"Dahl is in the tropic zone, so obviously we're going either north or south, and a considerable distance, too. If I had some notion in which direction the nightline was, I could tell which."
Eventually, they passed over a section of shoreline where there was a rim of ice hugging the domes where they were rimmed by the sea. And then, quite unexpectedly, the air jet angled downward. Rach screamed,
"We're going to hit! We're going to smash up!"
Seldon's abdominal muscles tightened, and he clutched the arms of his seat. Doris seemed unaffected. She said,
"The pilots up front don't seem alarmed. We'll be tunneling."
And as she said so, the jet's wings swept backward and under it, and like a bullet, the airjet entered a tunnel. Blackness swept back over them in an instant, and a moment later the lighting system in the tunnel turned on. The walls of the tunnel snaked past the jet on either side. "I don't suppose I'll ever be sure they know the tunnel isn't already occupied," muttered Selden. "I'm sure they had reassurance of a clear tunnel some dozens of kilometers earlier," said Doris. "At any rate, I presume this is the last stage of the journey, and soon we'll know where we are." She paused and then added, "And I further presume we won't like the knowledge when we have it." 84. The airjet sped out of the tunnel and onto a long runway, with a roof so high that it seemed closer to true daylight than anything Selden had seen since he had left the Imperial sector. They came to a halt in a shorter time than Selden would have expected, but at the price of an uncomfortable pressure forward. Rach, in particular, was crushed against the seat before him, and was finding it difficult to breathe till Dora's hand on his shoulder pulled him back slightly. Sergeant Thallus, impressive and erect, left the jet and moved to the rear, where he opened the door of the passenger compartment and helped the three out one by one. Selden was last. He half turned as he passed the sergeant, saying, "It was a pleasant trip, Sergeant." A slow smile spread over the sergeant's large face and lifted his mustachioed upper lip. He touched the visor of his cap in what was half a salute and said, "Thank you again, Doctor." They were then ushered into the back seat of a ground car of lavish design, and the sergeant himself pushed into the front seat and drove the vehicle with a surprisingly light touch. They passed through wide roadways, flanked by tall, well-designed buildings, all glistening in broad daylight. As elsewhere on Trantor, they heard the distant drone of an expressway. The walkways were crowded with what were, for the most part, well-dressed people. The surroundings were remarkably, almost excessively, clean. Selden's sense of security sank further. Dora's misgivings concerning their destination now seemed justified after all. He leaned toward her and said, "Do you think we are back in the Imperial sector?" She said, "No. The buildings are more rococo in the Imperial sector, and there's less Imperial parkishness to this sector, if you know what I mean."
"Then where are we, Doris?"
"We'll have to ask, I'm afraid, Harry." It was not a long trip, and soon they rolled into a car bay that flanked an imposing four-story structure. A frieze of imaginary animals ran along the top, decorated with strips of warm pink stone. It was an impressive facade with a rather pleasing design. Selden said, "That certainly looks rococo enough." Doris shrugged uncertainly. Rach whistled, and said in a failing attempt to sound unimpressed,
"Hey, look at that fancy place."
Sergeant Thallus gestured to Selden, clearly indicating that he was to follow. Selden hung back, and also relying on the universal language of gesture, held out both arms, clearly including Doris and Rach. The sergeant hesitated in a slightly hangdog fashion at the impressive pink doorway. His mustache almost seemed to droop. Then he said gruffly,
"All three of you, then. My word of honor holds. Still, others may not feel obligated by my own obligation, you know."
Selden nodded. "I hold you responsible for your own deeds only, Sergeant." The sergeant was clearly moved, and for a moment his face lightened, as though he was considering the possibility of shaking Selden's hand, or expressing his heartfelt approval in some other way. He decided against it, however, and stepped onto the bottom step of the flight that led to the door. The stairs immediately began a stately upward movement. Selden and Doris stepped after him at once and kept their balance without much trouble. Rach, who was momentarily staggered in surprise, jumped onto the moving stairs after a short run, shoved both hands into his pockets, and whistled carelessly. The door opened, and two women stepped out, one on either side in symmetrical fashion. They were young and attractive. Their dresses, belted tightly about the waist and reaching nearly to their ankles, fell in crisp pleats and rustled when they walked. Both had brown hair that was coiled in thick plaits on either side of their heads. Selden found it attractive, but wondered how long it took them each morning to arrange it just so. He had not been aware of so elaborate a coiffure on the women they had passed in the streets. The two women stared at the newcomers with obvious contempt. Selden was not surprised. After the day's events, he and Doris looked almost as disreputable as Rach. Yet the women managed to bow decorously, and then made a half-turn and gestured inward in perfect unison, and with symmetry carefully maintained. Did they rehearse these things? It was clear that the three were to enter. They stepped through an elaborate room, cluttered with furniture and decorative items whose use Selden did not readily understand. The floor was light-colored, springy, and glowed with luminescence. Selden noted with some embarrassment that their footwear left dusty marks upon it. And then an inner door was flung open, and yet another woman emerged. She was distinctly older than the first two, who sank slowly as she came in, crossing their legs symmetrically as they did so, in a way that made Selden marvel that they could keep their balance. It undoubtedly took a deal of practice. Selden wondered if he too was expected to display some ritualized form of respect. But since he hadn't the faintest notion of what this might consist of, he merely bowed his head slightly. Doris remained standing erect, and it seemed to Selden did so with disdain. Rach was staring open-mouthed in all directions, and looked as though he didn't even see the woman who had just entered. She was plump, not fat, but comfortably padded. She wore her hair precisely as the young ladies did, and her dress was in the same style, but much more richly ornamented. Too much so to suit Selden's aesthetic notions. She was clearly middle-aged, and there was a hint of gray in her hair. But the dimples in her cheeks gave her the appearance of having rather more than a dash of youth. Her light brown eyes were merry, and on the whole she looked more motherly than old. She said, "How are you, all of you?" She showed no surprise at the presence of Doris and Rach, but included them easily in her greeting. "I've been waiting for you for some time, and almost had you on Upperside at Streeling. You are Dr. Harry Selden, whom I've been looking forward to meeting. You, I think, must be Dr. Doris Van Eberle, for you had been reported to be in his company. This young man I fear I do not know, but I am pleased to see him. But we must not spend our time talking, for I'm sure you would like to rest first." "And bathe, madam," said Doris rather forcefully. "Each of us could use a thorough shower." "Yes, certainly," said the woman. "And a change in clothing, especially the young man." She looked down at Rach without any of the look of contempt and disapproval that the two young women had shown. She said, "What is your name, young man?"
"Rach,"
said Rach, in a rather choked and embarrassed voice. He then added experimentally,
"Mrs."
"What an odd coincidence," said the woman, her eyes sparkling. "An omen, perhaps. My own name is Rachel. Isn't that odd? But come, we shall take care of you all. Then there will be plenty of time to have dinner and to talk." "Wait, madam," said Doris.
May I ask where we are?
Why, dear? And please call me Rachel as you come to feel more friendly. I am always at ease with informality.
Doris stiffened.
Are you surprised that we ask? Isn't it natural that we should want to know where we are?
Rachel laughed in a pleasant, tinkling manner. Really, Dr. Van Abbele, something must be done about the name of this place. I was not asking a question, but making a statement. You asked where you were, and I did not ask you why. I told you why. You are in the Y sector.
In Y? Said Selden forcibly.
Yes, indeed, Dr. Selden. We've wanted you from the day you addressed the decennial convention, and we are so glad to have you now.
85. Actually, it took a full day to rest and unstiffen, to wash and get clean, to obtain new clothes, satiny and rather loose in the style of Y, and to sleep a good deal. It was during the second evening in Y that there was the dinner that Madame Rachel had promised. The table was a large one, too large considering that there were only four dining: Harry Selden, Doris Van Abbele, Rach, and Rachel. The walls and ceiling were softly illuminated, and the colors changed at a rate that caught the eye, but not so rapidly as in any way to discommode the mind. The very tablecloth, which was not cloth, Selden had not made up his mind what it might be, seemed to sparkle. The servers were many and silent, and when the door opened it seemed to Selden that he caught a glimpse of soldiers, armed and at the ready, outside. The room was a velvet glove, but the iron fist was not far distant. Rachel was gracious and friendly, and had clearly taken a particular liking to Rach, who, she insisted, was to sit next to her. Rach, scrubbed, polished, and shining, all but unrecognizable in his new clothes, with his hair clipped, cleaned, and brushed, scarcely dared to say a word. It was as though he felt his grammar no longer fit his appearance. He was pitifully ill at ease, and he watched Doris carefully as she switched from utensil to utensil, trying to match her exactly in every respect. The food was tasty, but spicy, to the point where Selden could not recognize the exact nature of the dishes. Rachel, her plump face made happy by her gentle smile and her fine teeth gleaming white, said, "You may think we have mycogenian additives in the food, but we do not. It's all homegrown in Y. There is no sector on the planet more self-sufficient than Y. We labor hard to keep that so." Selden nodded gravely and said, "Everything you have given us is first-rate, Rachel. We are much obliged to you." And yet within himself, he thought the food was not quite up to mycogenian standards. And he felt, moreover, as he had earlier muttered to Doris, that he was celebrating his own defeat, or Hummond's defeat at any rate, and that seemed to him to be the same thing. After all, he had been captured by Y, the very possibility that had so concerned Hummond at the time of the incident upperside. Rachel said, "Perhaps, in my role as hostess, I may be forgiven if I ask personal questions. Am I correct in assuming that you three do not represent a family? That you, Harry, and you, Doris, are not married, and that Rach is not your son?" "The three of us are not related in any way," said Selden. "Rach was born on Trantor, I on Helicon, Doris on Cinna."
"And how did you all meet, then?"
Selden explained briefly, and with as little detail as he could manage. "There's nothing romantic or significant in the meetings," he added.
"Yet I am given to understand that you raised difficulties with my personal aide, Sergeant Thallus, when he wanted to take only you out of Dahl." Selden said gravely, I had grown fond of Doris and Rach and did not wish to be separated from them.
Rachel smiled and said, You are a sentimental man, I see.
Yes, I am. Sentimental. And puzzled, too.
Puzzled?
Why, yes. And since you were so kind as to ask personal questions of us, may I ask one as well?
Of course, my dear Harry. Ask anything you please.
When we first arrived, you said that Y has wanted me from the day I addressed the decennial convention. For what reason might that be?
Surely you are not so simple as not to know. We want you for your psychohistory.
That much I do understand. But what makes you think that having me means you have psychohistory?
Surely you have not been so careless as to lose it.
Worse, Rachel, I have never had it.
Rachel's face dimpled.
But you said you had it in your talk. Not that I understood your talk. I am not a mathematician. I hate numbers. But I have in my employ mathematicians who have explained to me what it is you said.
In that case, my dear Rachel, you must listen more closely. I can well imagine they have told you that I have proven that psychohistorical predictions are conceivable, but surely they must also have told you that they are not practical.
I can't believe that, Harry. The very next day you were called into an audience with that pseudo-emperor Cleon.
The pseudo-emperor? Murmured Doris ironically.
Why, yes, said Rachel, as though she was answering a serious question. Pseudo-emperor. He has no true claim to the throne.
Rachel, said Selden, brushing that aside a bit impatiently, I told Cleon exactly what I have just told you, and he let me go.
Now Rachel did not smile. A small edge crept into her voice.
Yes, he let you go the way the cat in the fable lets a mouse go. He has been pursuing you ever since, in Streeling, in Mycogen, in Dahl. He would pursue you here if he dared. But come now, our serious talk is too serious. Let us enjoy ourselves. Let us have music.
And at her words, there suddenly sounded a soft but joyous instrumental melody. She leaned toward Rach and said softly,
My boy, if you are not at ease with the fork, use your spoon or your fingers. I won't mind.
Rach said, Yes, mum, and swallowed hard. But Doris caught his eye, and her lips silently mouthed, Fork. He remained with his fork.
Doris said, The music is lovely, madam.
She pointedly rejected the familiar form of address. But it must not be allowed to distract us.
There is the thought in my mind that the pursuer in all those places might have been in the employ of the Y sector.
Surely you would not be so well acquainted with events if Y were not the prime mover.
Rachel laughed aloud.
Y has its eyes and ears everywhere, of course. But we were not the pursuers. Had we been, you would have been picked up without fail, as you were in Dahl, finally, when, indeed, we were the pursuers. When, however, there is a pursuit that fails, a grasping hand that misses, you may be sure that it is Demerzel.
Do you think so little of Demerzel? Murmured Doris.
Yes. Does that surprise you? We have beaten him.
You or the Y sector?
The sector, of course. But insofar as Y is the victor, then I am the victor.
How strange, said Doris. There seems to be a prevalent opinion throughout Trantor that the inhabitants of Y have nothing to do with victory, with defeat, or with anything else. It is felt that there is but one will and one fist in Y, and that is that of the mayor,
Surely, you or any other Wyan weigh nothing in comparison.
Rachel smiled broadly. She paused to look at Rach benevolently and to pinch his cheek, then said,
If you believe that our mayor is an autocrat, and that there is but one will that sways why, then perhaps you are right. But even so, I can still use the personal pronoun, for my will is of account.
Why yours? Said Selden.
Why not?
Said Rachel, as the servers began clearing the table.
I am the mayor of Y.
86. It was Rach who was the first to react to the statement. Quite forgetting the cloak of civility that sat upon him so uncomfortably, he laughed raucously and said,
Hey, lady, you can't be mayor. Mayors is guys.
Rachel looked at him good-naturedly and said in a perfect imitation of his tone of voice,
Hey, kid, some mayors is guys and some mayors is dames. Put that under your lid and let it bubble.
Rach's eyes protruded and he seemed stunned. Finally, he managed to say,
Hey, you talk regular, lady.
Sure thing, regular as you want,
said Rachel, still smiling. Selden cleared his throat and said,
That's quite an accent you have, Rachel.
Rachel tossed her head slightly.
I haven't had occasion to use it in many years, but one never forgets. I once had a friend, a good friend who was a Dalite, when I was very young.
She sighed. He didn't speak that way, of course. He was quite intelligent. But he could do so if he wished, and he taught me. It was exciting to talk so with him. It created a world that excluded our surroundings. It was wonderful. It was also impossible. My father made that plain. And now along comes this young rascal Rach to remind me of those long-ago days. He has the accent, the eyes, the impudent cast of countenance, and in 6 years or so he will be a delight and terror to the young women. Won't you, Rach?
Rach said,
I don't know, lady. Mum?
I'm sure you will, and you will come to look very much like my old friend, and it will be much more comfortable for me not to see you then. And now dinner's over, and it's time for you to go to your room, Rach. You can watch Holovision for a while if you wish. I don't suppose you read.
Rach reddened.
I'm gonna read someday. Master Selden says I'm gonna.
Then I'm sure you will.
A young woman approached Rach, curtsying respectfully in Rochelle's direction. Selden had not seen the signal that had summoned her. Rach said,
Can't I stay with Master Selden and Mrs. Venabile?
You'll see them later, said Rachel gently. But Master and Mrs. and I have to talk right now, so you must go.
Doris mouthed a firm, Go at Rach, and with a grimace the boy slid out of his chair and followed the attendant. Rachel turned to Selden and Doris once Rach was gone and said,
The boy will be safe, of course, and treated well. Please have no fears about that.
And I will be safe, too. As my woman approached just now, so will a dozen armed men, and much more rapidly when summoned. I want you to understand that.
Selden said evenly, We are in no way thinking of attacking you, Rachel, or must I now say, Madam Mayor?
Still, Rachel. I am given to understand that you are a wrestler of sorts, Harry, and you, Doris, are very skillful with the knives we have removed from your room. I don't want you to rely uselessly on your skills, since I want Harry alive, unharmed, and friendly.
It is quite well understood, Madam Mayor, said Doris, her lack of friendship uncompromised, that the ruler of Y,
now and for the past 40 years, is Mannix, fourth of that name, and that he is still alive and in full possession of his faculties. Who then are you really?
Exactly who I say I am, Dors. Mannix the fourth is my father. He is, as you say, still alive and in possession of his faculties. In the eyes of the Emperor and of all the Empire, he is mayor of Wai. But he is weary of the strains of power, and is willing, at last, to let them slip into my hands, which are just as willing to receive them. I am his only child, and I was brought up all my life to rule. My father is therefore mayor in law and name, but I am mayor in fact. It is to me now that the armed forces of Wai have sworn allegiance, and in Wai that is all that counts.
Selden nodded.
Let it be as you say. But even so, whether it is Mayor Mannix the Fourth or Mayor Rachel the First, it is the first, I suppose, there is no purpose in your holding me. I have told you that I don't have a workable psychohistory, and I do not think that either I or anyone else will ever have one. I have told that to the Emperor. I am of no use either to you or to him.
Rachel said, How naive you are. Do you know the history of the Empire?
Selden shook his head. I have recently come to wish that I knew it much better.
Dors said dryly, I know imperial history quite well, though the pre-imperial age is my specialty, Madam Mayor. But what does it matter whether we do or do not?
If you know your history, you know that the House of Wai is ancient and honorable, and is descended from the Dacian dynasty.
Dors said, The Dacians ruled 5,000 years ago. The number of their descendants in the 150 generations that have lived and died since then may number half the population of the galaxy, if all genealogical claims, however outrageous, are accepted.
Our genealogical claims, Dr. Vanabeli. Rachel's tone of voice was, for the first time, cold and unfriendly, and her eyes flashed like steel, are not outrageous. They are fully documented. The House of Wai has maintained itself consistently in positions of power through all those generations, and there have been occasions when we have held the imperial throne and have ruled as emperors.
The history book films, said Dors, usually refer to the Wai rulers as anti-emperors, never recognized by the bulk of the empire.
It depends on who writes the history book films. In the future we will, for the throne which has been ours will be ours again.
To accomplish that, you must bring about civil war.
There won't be much risk of that, said Rachel. She was smiling again. That is what I must explain to you, because I want Dr. Selden's help in preventing such a catastrophe. My father, Mannix the Fourth, has been a man of peace all his life.